So this is the fourth and last week of our four-week series on the Four Noble Truths. Can everyone hear me? Okay. So first, I just want to overview Four Noble Truths. They're the most fundamental of the Buddhist teachings, and the Buddha said that all of his teachings could be subsumed by the Four Noble Truths. And they are the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. He didn't teach these as metaphysical statements meant to be believed, but rather as truths meant to be experienced in our own lives. And to that end, he suggested four actions, one for each truth. So the truth of suffering is meant to be understood. The truth of the cause of suffering is meant to be abandoned. The truth of the cessation of suffering is meant to be realized. And the truth of the path of the cessation of suffering is meant to be developed or cultivated. So the nature of the Dharma is very practical. It's not a set of beliefs. It's a set of tools, of practices to help us understand our experiences in our lives. So at the core of the practice is the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the path leading to the cessation of suffering, and this is the Fourth Noble Truth. So the Noble Eightfold Path, its eight factors or aspects are right understanding, right thought or right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. The Eightfold Path can be seen as eight different qualities of heart and mind that we cultivate as we practice. These qualities are not and really cannot be developed separately from each other. I think you'll find if you choose one of these to be the focus of your practice for a time, you'll find that others are cultivated along with it. So while I discuss these aspects of the Eightfold Path, and I'm going to go over them all in quite a bit of detail, keep in mind that they can't really be separated from each other. But in spite of that, there is a kind of standard ordering or a way in which to look at the Eightfold Path as a kind of a sequential set of steps in our practice. And I did go over this briefly last week. So the Buddha suggested that our practice is grounded in ethical conduct. And out of that base of ethical conduct, that supports the training of the mind in concentration, which then allows us to see things more clearly with wisdom. This is the path of gradual training. It begins with ethics, leads into concentration, and culminates with wisdom. So I'll use this framework to go over the Eightfold Path. So one place to begin our path of practice is within our relationship to the world, within our relationship to how we get along with other people. It's helpful in our spiritual practice to start from a base where our relationships with others are grounded in honorable and compassionate behavior. So this is the practice of ethics. This isn't necessarily for reasons of morality, as we usually think of morality, where you might think, I should do X because it's right, or I shouldn't do Y because it's wrong. Rather, the basis of ethics in Buddhist practice has to do with the cultivation of clarity of mind and clarity of intention. When we start paying attention to our actions, we learn for ourselves that certain actions lead to clarity in our minds. So, for example, last week I gave an example about lying to a friend. If you have just lied to a friend and then you sit down and try to meditate, you might find that the mind keeps going back to that incident and trying to figure out how to keep all the relationships in order around that lie. Oh, what if they tell that person? Or how do I keep this person from finding out what I said to this person? It can get quite convoluted, and the mind can't really settle in concentration. So as we begin to value clarity in our minds and pay attention to our actions and their consequences, not only for ourselves but for others, we see that there's not so much of a distinction between what's good for ourselves and what's good for others. We begin to see things in terms of skillful and unskillful, and wholesome and unwholesome, instead of between right and wrong. So in the Noble Eightfold Path, the training in ethical conduct, or sila, contains the factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. So starting with right speech. Speech is one of the main ways that we interact with the world, and it can have a huge impact on our lives. I'm sure that most of us have had the experience of wishing we could take back something that we said to someone. Bringing speech into our daily practice is a powerful way to sharpen our mindfulness. Tan Jeff is a monk in the Thai forest tradition. Tan Jeff says that his teacher used to say, "If you can't control your mouth, how can you hope to control your mind?" And Gil likes to call the practice of right speech mindfulness out loud. But the practice of right speech can be very challenging. Indeed, for me, it is probably one of the most challenging practices. Much of the time, we speak automatically without noticing first that we're going to speak, much less what we're going to say. And even less often do we take a moment to consider how what we're going to say will be received by the person we're saying it to. A great exercise to try is just to pause before we speak. Just pause. That itself can be quite a difficult practice. But if you, in that pause, if you allow yourself that pause, if you pay attention, first thing you'll notice is, oh, I'm going to speak. And in that pause, you may get to see two things. First, you'll probably know what you're going to say before it comes out of your mouth. And second, you might see the motivation or the intention behind what you're going to say, why you're going to say what you're going to say. Getting in touch with the intentions for why we speak can be quite eye-opening. We can find a number of different reasons why we would speak. We might speak because we want to impress someone, or because we want to avoid saying something else, or because we want them to like us, or maybe even because we want to lash out at them and hurt them. The list of reasons that we speak are probably endless, but when we start to pay attention to our motivations for speaking, we'll probably find two or three that are our top favorites. The Buddha provided some guidelines about how to cultivate right speech. He gave a list of four types of speech that is phrased in the negative as types of speech to avoid. And these four types of speech to avoid are false speech, divisive speech, abusive speech, and idle chatter. And I'm going to read to you from the sutta that describes these because it gives a pretty clear definition of each of these. There is the case where a certain person, abandoning false speech, abstains from false speech. When he has been called to a town meeting, a group meeting, a gathering of his relatives, his guild, or of the royalty, if he is asked as a witness, "Come and tell, good man, what you know." If he doesn't know, he says, "I don't know." If he does know, he says, "I know." If he hasn't seen, he says, "I haven't seen." If he has seen, he says, "I have seen." Thus, he doesn't consciously tell a lie for his own sake, for the sake of another, or for the sake of any reward. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks the truth, holds to the truth, is firm, reliable, no deceiver of the world. Abandoning divisive speech, he abstains from divisive speech. What he has heard here, he does not tell there, to break those people apart from these people here. What he has heard here, he does not tell there, to break these people apart from those people there. Thus reconciling those who have been broken apart, or cementing those who are united, he loves concord, delights in concord, enjoys concord, speaks things that create concord. Abandoning abusive speech, he abstains from abusive speech. He speaks words that are soothing to the ear, that are affectionate, that go to the heart, that are polite, appealing, and pleasing to people at large. Abandoning idle chatter, he abstains from idle chatter. He speaks in season, speaks what is factual, and what is in accordance with the goal. So our task is not really so much to follow these as hard and fast rules, but rather to pay attention when this type of speech comes up and see if we can get in touch with the motivation behind the speech. There are many gray areas in right speech, and we each have to explore this ourselves. In my own practice, one major exploration around this issue has been idle chatter. I found that at times, when I would go to a gathering, what I would consider to be idle chatter actually served the purpose of connecting people so that they could go on to have a deeper conversation. So I found that in many cases, actually, in our culture at least, idle chatter actually serves a purpose. Or another gray area that some of us may have come across in their lives, the motivation to lie to someone because we think it will help them, or because we think that not lying to them would hurt them. So the motivation for this seems to come from a place of caring for the other person, and does come from a place of caring for the other person. But probably, or maybe what we need to look at is another way to express that caring, rather than through a lie. Aside from these four types of speech to avoid, the Buddha also had some suggestions about how to decide what to say, given that it had passed these four criteria. So those two are, is it beneficial to say? And the Buddha didn't actually say we should not say things to others that they didn't want to hear. But he did want us to consider whether this difficult topic is something that's beneficial to their well-being or the well-being of the community. The other thing to consider, is it a proper time for speaking? I take this to mean we should consider who's present, what the general mood of the gathering is, and whether or not the people or person we're speaking to will be able to hear what we have to say. So, for example, if we're trying to communicate some kind of constructive criticism to a person who is angry, that might not be the time, that might not be the proper time to speak, but rather to wait a day or two until they've cooled down. So the next aspect of the Eightfold Path is right action, and this reminds us to be aware of how we use our bodies to relate to the world. As with right speech, the Buddha described right action in terms of behavior that should be avoided. He said that we should refrain from killing, from stealing, and from sexual misconduct. Some Buddhist teachings stress that the intention that accompanies the action is crucial. So the aspects of right action might be reworded as refraining from the intention to kill, or from following through on the intention to kill, refraining from the intention to steal, or from following through on the intention to steal, and refraining from the intention to misuse sexuality, or from following through on the intention to misuse sexuality. Now, maybe this seems a fine point, but consider the two following scenarios. In one case, you're walking across the lawn and you step on a spider and it dies. In the second case, you're sitting in your living room and you see a spider on your wall and you really want to get rid of it and you pick up your shoe and you whack it. So the state of mind in those two situations is very different. And remember that the Buddhist path is very much about cultivating qualities of mind. So in the first case, you may not have even been aware that there was a spider there. There was no intention to kill. In the second case, there was the definite intention to kill a living being, which was followed through on. So in addition, this teaching about looking at the intention points out that right action is not compromised while we are still struggling with our minds. So if you're sitting in the living room and you see that spider and you really hate it and you really want to kill it, but then you remember, oh, maybe I shouldn't do that, and you scoop it up and you take it outside, that's right action. The fact that you had that intention in your mind doesn't compromise the fact that the action was considered right action. So the first aspect of right action is refraining from killing, which is what I've been talking about a little bit here. But for lay people, this primarily means refraining from killing human beings. And maybe this seems obvious or even perhaps easy to follow, but imagine if everyone in the world followed this single rule of conduct, what a different world it would be. So in addition to refraining from killing human beings, the suttas say we should be merciful and compassionate with all living beings. So this can be a gray area. Consider the case of malarial mosquitoes, where if they're left unchecked, they can cause great harm for many, many people. Or even the case of defending yourself if someone is attacking you. So these are things that we need to explore ourselves, and only in our own minds can we make the decision about how we act. But as you make this exploration, try to remember the intention and the motivation are key aspects to observe. We should try to refrain from acting if the motivation is coming out of greed, hatred, or delusion. Instead, we should try to act from a place of non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion, a place of compassion and respect for all human beings, including ourselves. Sharon Salzberg, one of the teachers at the Insight Meditation Society, tells a story that kind of illustrates this principle. She was in India at one point and traveling through the streets, and she was in a rickshaw with a friend. And they were going through a kind of a narrow alley, and an attacker came up and grabbed her and tried to pull her out of the rickshaw. And her friend managed to keep her away, and they managed to get her away from the attacker, and they escaped and went on. But she was quite shaken. And she, when she got back to her village, she talked to her teacher, and she told him the story. And he said to her, "Did you have your umbrella with you?" And she looked a little startled at this, but she said, "Yes." And he said, "With all the loving kindness in your heart, you should have hit him over the head with your umbrella." So if you can manage to hit someone over the head with loving kindness in your heart. The second aspect of right action is to refrain from stealing, which is also worded as refraining from taking what is not given. There are many levels and gradations of subtlety to explore here. Most of us are not going to go out and rob a bank or break into a house, but how many of us have taken office supplies from work or borrowed something from a friend without asking? Working with this aspect of right action, we might even come to consider very subtle issues of how we use the planet's resources. The more we reflect on any aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, the more subtle and finer our sensitivity becomes. The third aspect of right action is to refrain from sexual misconduct. In the suttas, this usually refers to adultery or to sexual involvement with any promised person. The suttas say not to get sexually involved even with even those crowned by flowers. The spirit of refraining from sexual misconduct is not to act out of sexual desire in such a way that would harm another person. Sexual energy can be very powerful, and we're asked to take care with that power. We need to take care that we don't act on unskillful motivations and bring conscious choice into our actions in our sexual relationships. Rounding out the training in ethics is right livelihood. And I'll speak only briefly about this because its essence is to find livelihood which compromises neither right speech nor right action. The Buddha did clearly exclude 5 specific occupations for lay people who wanted to follow his training. And those are trading in weapons, trading in human beings, which includes prostitution and slavery, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poisons. But in our day and age, with so many different occupations, perhaps it's more helpful to just ask whether right speech and right action are fulfilled in our work. For example, if a job as a salesperson requires lying in order to make a sale, perhaps we should avoid that occupation or at least try to find ways that we don't have to lie in our job. Again, as with other aspects of ethical conduct, there are gray areas and we need to look at our motivation. For example, computer manufacture. The computer is kind of a neutral thing. It can be used for healthcare and it can be used for waging war. So if someone's intention in participating in the manufacture of computers is to provide a tool for the betterment of mankind, then that can be considered right livelihood. On the other hand, if their intention is to make as much money as possible and to go out and find as many government defense agencies to sell it to as possible so they can make more money, there's little doubt that would add more suffering to the world and probably to their own lives. As we train in right speech, right action, and right livelihood, our sense of what causes harm and suffering to ourselves and to others becomes more and more refined. We learn from observing our actions and our motivations what leads to suffering and what leads to happiness and peace. As we experience that happiness and peace, we more and more often choose the road that leads there. As we cultivate harmony in our relationships with others and our mind becomes happy, and more serene, we live our outer lives with the intention of compassion and peacefulness, and it has a powerful impact on our inner lives and paves the way for the second aspect of the gradual training, the training in concentration or samadhi. In the Eightfold Path, samadhi comprises right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So as we've cultivated right speech, right action, and right livelihood, we've gained an appreciation for those actions and qualities of mind that lead away from suffering and towards happiness and peace. We see the benefit of making the effort to do that, and it does require effort. Anyone who has tried to keep a New Year's resolution knows how hard it is to make a change. We need to resolve over and over and over again to cultivate these qualities. This is the basis of right effort, which takes as its foundation an understanding of what is wholesome or skillful and what is unwholesome or unskillful. While right speech, right action, and right livelihood are primarily about cultivating wholesome actions, right effort is primarily about cultivating wholesome states of mind. The simplest definition I know of for wholesome qualities of mind are those that are not based in greed, hatred, and delusion. So wholesome qualities are states like joy, happiness, generosity, loving kindness, equanimity, compassion, mindfulness, tranquility, peace. Unwholesome qualities are states based in greed, hatred, and delusion, such as anger, sloth, hatred, restlessness, boredom, lust for power and money, despair, aversion. These are all of those states that either are dukkha, are suffering, or lead towards dukkha. So right effort is of four kinds, and I'm going to list these. Effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not yet arisen, and I'll explain these in a minute. Effort toward the abandoning of unwholesome states that have arisen. Effort toward the arousal of wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And effort towards the sustaining of wholesome states that have arisen. So the first, effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not arisen. Maybe this sounds obscure or difficult, but what this amounts to is understanding what situations, understanding through having observed and been mindful, what situations lead to suffering, and then striving to avoid those situations. So perhaps we know that having a political conversation, a discussion with our parents about politics, inevitably leads, when our parents don't share our political views, inevitably leads us to frustration, hostility, and argument. One way to avoid the arising of these mind states is to not have those conversations, just not to go there. Or perhaps we decide to keep the conversation short and change the subject when we see our minds heading in that direction. So that's the first, effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not yet arisen. The second kind of right effort is the effort to abandon unwholesome states that have arisen. This means that we notice when we're caught in anger or confusion or despair, we're caught up in some unwholesome state of mind. We make the effort to let go of it. This letting go can have an active quality in which we see that this state of mind is unskillful and leads to suffering, and through that we can let go of it. Perhaps we've also learned some techniques. There's some specific techniques for letting go of these unwholesome states, one of which is if you're in a state of anger, to replace the thoughts of anger with thoughts of love and kindness. So there are techniques also to let go of unwholesome states of mind. But the letting go can also happen by using mindfulness to observe it, rather than actively trying to do anything with it. Mindfulness helps us to disengage from the momentum of the unwholesome quality of mind, kind of like I talked about last week, where mindfulness functions like putting a car into neutral, that the mind doesn't stop immediately when the mindfulness is engaged, but the quality will stop of its own accord, as a car would stop of its own accord when it's put into neutral. When we observe a whole unwholesome quality of mind with mindfulness, we can see that it will let go of itself if we just observe it and have patience. So that's the second one, the abandoning of unwholesome states of mind that have arisen. The third kind of right effort is the effort to arouse wholesome mind states that have not yet arisen. In order to cultivate wholesome mind states that are not present, there are two main ways to do this. One is to abstain from situations that are opposed to those qualities of mind, and the other is to put ourselves into the situations that will lead to those qualities of mind. So, for example, if we practice right speech through refraining from lying, we are cultivating the quality of truthfulness. Each of the aspects of right speech and right action is an action to avoid, which helps to cultivate a corresponding positive quality of mind. We can also try to cultivate positive qualities of mind through positive action. For example, we could cultivate generosity through the practice of giving, or cultivate loving kindness through the practice of actively thinking and cultivating loving thoughts. This is the practice of metta. So that's the third kind of right effort, the effort to arouse wholesome mind states that have not yet arisen. The fourth kind of right effort is the effort to sustain wholesome mind states that have already arisen. When wholesome qualities of mind have arisen and we notice them, it can sometimes seem surprising that it actually does take effort to sustain them. or to allow them to continue. I've often noticed in my own practice a tendency in experiencing a wholesome quality, tranquility and calm is one common for me that this happens. I'm experiencing calm and I notice that it's, oh, calm, that's nice. Now what do I have to do? What are all the things I have to do today? So the mind will almost immediately leave the calm and start searching for other things. So in my experience, one of the most effective ways to sustain a wholesome mind state when it has arisen is to be mindful of it. Pay attention to them and appreciate them. Don't let the mind, don't run away from them by letting the mind become busy with a thought pattern or the body become busy with some activity. Our cultivation of right effort has ramification in our daily lives, and I hope that you see how it comes into play in the cultivation of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. But it is also crucial in the development of our meditation, and the cultivation of the concentration or samadhi aspect of the gradual path, of the gradual training, is a cultivation of meditation. So the act of sitting down to meditate itself is an expression of right effort. It's the third kind of right effort, the effort to arouse wholesome qualities that have not yet arisen. We're intending to cultivate the wholesome qualities of mindfulness and concentration when we sit down to meditate. My teacher in Burma, Sayadaw Upandita, likes to talk about launching effort, which is what gets us to the cushion. And then during our meditation, we continue to strengthen the qualities of mindfulness and concentration by coming back to them over and over again. Upandita calls this sustaining effort. Over and over again in our meditation, we come back to the object of attention rather than being lost in our thoughts. So as we cultivate right effort, we can really see the value of mindfulness. In fact, in terms of cultivating wholesome mind states, there's one quality above all others that is worth cultivating. And that is right mindfulness, the next factor of the Eightfold Path. Sometimes people think that mindfulness stands in opposition to right effort. They hear the instruction in right effort to abandon unwholesome mind states, while the instruction in mindfulness is to let it be. However, I hope you've understood from our discussion over the last few weeks that mindfulness can function as a very gentle way of letting go of unwholesome mind states. And when we're mindful of unwholesome mind states, the letting it be actually allows it to let go of itself over time and with patience. In fact, mindfulness actually contains the four right efforts within it. Mindfulness has this kind of magical quality of strengthening wholesome states and diminishing unwholesome states. It's as if the wholesome qualities of mind bask in the light and warmth of mindfulness, and the unwholesome qualities shrink from the brightness and clarity. The more we cultivate wholesome qualities of mind through mindfulness, the more likely they are to arise in the future, and the more we abandon the unwholesome qualities of mind through mindfulness, the less likely they are to arise. In addition, when we use mindfulness to cultivate the wholesome qualities and to abandon the unwholesome, we are also strengthening mindfulness itself. As Upandita liked to say, mindfulness is the most wholesome mind state. A good definition for mindfulness might be a quality of non-judgmental awareness of what is happening while it is happening. The while it is happening piece of the definition is crucial in mindfulness. Awareness is happening all the time, but often we're just passively aware of what is happening. And by this I mean, suppose you're involved in some kind of activity and yet your mind is kind of lost out in the vacation that you're going to be doing next week. And if somebody comes up to you and says, hey, tell me what you were just doing, you could tell them, probably in fair amount of detail, what you had been doing. So there was awareness happening then, but the awareness was not really synchronous with the activity as it was taking place. Mindfulness has a brightness and a clarity to it that's very obvious once we become familiar with it. We can begin to notice this clarity by seeing if we can notice the difference between that passive form of awareness that I just described and the more active form of mindfulness. The best place to do this is when we first wake up, because there's still a lingering memory of what the mind felt like the moment before. The contrast between the two types of awareness can become quite plain. And when we know what mindfulness feels like, we can begin to appreciate it even more and begin to notice it even more. Probably the hardest thing about mindfulness is remembering to do it. See if you can find ways to remind yourself. It can be helpful to choose common events that happen in your life, and let them serve as mindfulness bells, or put notes up around the house. I did that for a while. The telephone ringing is a great one. It even has a bell-like quality. At one point in my practice, when the phone rang on my desk at work, I would stop what I was doing, and I would let the phone ring 3 times, and I just allowed myself to be present and mindful during those 3 rings. This had the advantage that when I picked up the phone, I was present for whoever was on the other end. Or you can choose other common events in your life. Walking through a door, or switching a light switch, turning on the faucet, anything fairly neutral in your life that you do over and over again. Just have it serve to wake you up for a moment. Oh, what's happening? What's my state of mind? How does my body feel? For a week, pick some activity to do that with. And then the next week, pick a different one. And then the next week, a different one. And you'll find that mindfulness begins to filter throughout your day in that way. In the past few weeks, we've been talking quite a bit about mindfulness. It's crucial. It's a crucial part of the Four Noble Truths. Mindfulness is used so that we can understand suffering, the first noble truth. It's used to help us let go of the cause of suffering, the second noble truth. We have to be mindful, we have to be present to realize the cessation of suffering, the third noble truth. And mindfulness is crucial in cultivating the qualities of heart and mind that lead to the cessation of suffering, the fourth noble truth. So the cultivation of mindfulness aids us in our development of our meditation and of right concentration. Most forms of meditation fall into one of two categories, either concentration practices or mindfulness practices, or awareness practices, you could call them. Concentration practices use a one-pointed focus on a single object to calm and steady the mind. One of the most commonly used objects of attention for concentration practices is the breath. Another commonly used object is the cultivation of wholesome mind states such as loving kindness. The mind can become quite absorbed in a state of loving kindness. Other objects that are sometimes used are mantras or the creation of a mental image that's sustained in the mind. The mind becomes absorbed into the object, and in deep states of concentration, everything falls away but the object. It produces very wholesome and healing states of body and mind. It's a very healing practice, concentration is. The body and mind become composed and collected, relaxed, calm, joyful, and tranquil. Awareness practices cultivate mindfulness, the non-judgmental, open awareness of what is happening while it's happening. In the instructions for mindfulness that we give here, we usually start by encouraging people to be mindfulness, to be mindful and pay attention to just one aspect of their experience, like the breath or sounds, and then open up to more experiences as their mindfulness gets stronger. Both forms of meditation bring both mindfulness and concentration into the practice, but emphasize one over the other. For example, if we're using the breath as an object of concentration, we need to use mindfulness to see when we've slipped off of the object and bring it back to the breath. If we're primarily doing awareness practice, attending to whatever arises in the present moment, concentration serves two purposes. It steadies the mind so that it can see rapidly changing experience, and it also helps us to attend more carefully and to see more detail in what is happening. Mindfulness and concentration are not obscure states of mind. They operate all the time in our normal daily life. Any time that we're absorbed in something, a book, our work, or a fantasy, concentration is functioning. Anytime you know what's happening while it's happening, you're mindful. If you put your hand under the faucet and the water is hot and you know it's hot, that's mindfulness. What we're trying to do in meditation is to cultivate these very natural qualities of mind so that we can make choices about what we do with our minds. Together, concentration and mindfulness allow the mind to penetrate very deeply into the state of reality, into the nature of our own minds. They both need to be cultivated in a very strong way in order for insight to arise. Mindfulness supported by concentration leads to insight, and that insight is wisdom, which is the third aspect of the gradual training of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path is comprised of right understanding and right intention or right thought. Right understanding is described in many ways, but the basic way that wisdom or insight is seen to unfold is through the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. As we practice and follow the Eightfold Path, our understanding of and insight into the Four Noble Truths becomes more and more clear. The Eightfold Path can be thought of as a spiral. We cycle through each of the aspects of the path at deeper and deeper levels. We can begin to see extremely subtle levels of clinging that lead to even more ways that we can let go. With a complete understanding of the Four Noble Truths, the mind becomes free of clinging, and it naturally opens to states like loving kindness, compassion, and equanimity. The expression of an enlightened mind is to be free from greed, hatred, and delusion, which means that our intentions are pure. This is the culmination of right thought or right intention, which the definition of which is thought or intention free from greed, hatred, and delusion. So the culmination of the path is the wisdom found in right understanding, and the manifestation or expression of that understanding is right intention. So I've talked a long time, and I'd like to open it up for comments or questions about anything that I've said tonight, or if anybody has any comments they want to give about the exercise I suggested from last week, I'd be happy to hear that. So anything at all. Yes.
I wonder about this, the term delusion. How, suppose someone is deluded, and I mean, by definition, they don't know anything. And so they're, how does Buddhism deal with that?
Well, the mindfulness, as we cultivate mindfulness, we begin to see what we don't see. So, delusion is seen as basically probably the most unwholesome mind state. It's the absence of awareness, the absence of mindfulness, the absence of knowing the truth. So the whole practice of Buddhism is to cultivate states of mind that help us to see where we are deluded. So it's a slow process. It's a very slow process. Actually, one other interesting piece of that that's a little counterintuitive in our way of thinking. But if somebody takes an action out of hatred, and they know that it's unwholesome, and yet they take that action anyway. In our culture, we think of that as a really bad kind of thing to do. But if they take that action and they don't know that it's a bad action, in the Buddhist way of considering things, that's even worse. An action taken out of delusion that's an unwholesome action is worse than an action taken when you know that the action is bad. And the reasoning behind this is that if you don't know that the action is bad, you throw your whole being into the action. And if you know the action is bad, there's some part of you that holds back from it. So that's just one point that I think is different in terms of the Buddhist culture and our own. You know, it's an interesting reflection for me to think about that. It's just one thing I can think of. Yeah.
In following that up a little.
Sure.
Is it wholesome or unwholesome to point out to a deluded person that their action was deluded?
That depends on your intention.
I don't mean to get convoluted.
No, I think it can be. But again, I think, you know, you can look at the teachings of right speech there. You know, will they be able to hear it? Is it the right time to say it? Are you speaking it out of a place of love and compassion yourself? Or is there some anger in your mind that, oh, that person was deluded and I really want to tell them? So a lot of it just has to do with your own state of mind, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. So wholesome actions are those that are motivated out of non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. The delusion one is hard, though. You can't not act. I mean, we have to act, and we know that if you've been doing this practice for a while, you know that you're full of delusion and you're acting out of delusion. But oh well, you know, you just have to keep going and keep looking and keep refining your sensitivity. Well, if there aren't any more comments or questions, we can end here. That's fine. It's been a pleasure to spend this 4 weeks with you. And good evening.